friends.
I'm Katie.
And I'm Olivia.
And we are Podcast by Proxy, Canadian True Crime.
Welcome.
We're live. Again, in 1 week.
We're live again. We're live to finish off the very, very sad, awful case of Melanie Bittersing. Yeah,
I will be kind of happy when this is over.
Yeah.
Just because it's so tragic.
Yeah, it's pretty awful, for sure.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot because we just talked in our first episode.
And recorded like 2 days ago, which is like... We had like a 20-minute catch-up before that, so... Yeah.
I was on Facebook this morning, though, and I saw Morgan Wallen, like country singer.
Got arrested
last night for throwing a chair off of a balcony at a bar. He seems to find himself in the news quite a bit for disorderly conduct when drinking.
Yeah. I'm a little surprised when I see... Well, actually, I'm almost not surprised now when I see his name in the news because...
I'm never surprised anymore. Like,
it just seems like a little bit of a shit disturber.
I just feel like it's been going on for a long time. Like, I remember on this show legitimately 2 years ago, us talking about Morgan Wallen drinking and being in the news for it. And I'm like, buddy.
Well, because he said some racist thing.
He did, yeah.
And then he everybody like, seems to get canceled for that. And yet he got quite a big break on that, I think, overall. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think it impacted him as grandiosely as most people.
No, he's been huge in the last year.
Yeah.
Brandon cannot stand Morgan Wallen.
Really? I love him.
And like, he loves country music and has really jumped on the country train since we've gotten together, but he just sees it and he's like, nope.
I can read him like a book.
He said he's the biggest bro he's ever seen.
Which I don't feel like you get, like, bro and country music mixed together as much as you'd hear. So, like, that's a big statement.
Yeah, he doesn't like him. But that's okay. To each their own.
Yeah.
Okay, where did we leave off? We currently are in the middle of Everton Bittersing's trial for the abuse and death of his daughter, Melanie. If you did not listen to episode 1, I highly recommend it because there's a lot of information there that will make this episode make sense. But just as a little bit of a recap, Melanie's remains were found in 1994, shoved in a suitcase and lit on fire. She was not identified for 20 years. Until police received a phone call in November of 2011 and ended up identifying her remains. So currently we are halfway through Everton, her father's trial for her murder. And we just heard from her older brother, Cleon, as to some of the conduct and abuse that they experienced during the short amount of time that they lived with their father and their stepmother.
Yeah. I don't even feel like he should be allowed to be called her father anymore.
No, I completely agree. It's actually, when I was writing it, it kept being really hard to, like, say that. And especially because Cleon and the other children often are like, we don't even use his name anymore. Like, there's just so,
like,
much
him,
shame and awfulness, like, associated with... Well, they don't use, like, his last name. Like, they just can't even bring themselves to, like, pass on... Like, Cleon, for example, did not pass on the last name Bittersing to his children.
No, he used his mother's maiden name, didn't he?
I don't know something what like name that. He used, but I know he did not use his... Everton's
those are the circumstances where you get married and you take your wife's last name.
Correct. 100%.
Like, you just, there's one-offs where your family history has been so bad, or you make up a new last name together.
Have I told you on that note that Brandon, like, dead serious, wants to combine our last names?
Not, like, hyphenate or,
no.
Like,
combine.
Oh, my God. Like, Radbauer?
That's the one.
Wow.
That is it. He
keeps, not Wassmore?
I thought he was kidding. for a while, and then he keeps bringing it up. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Really, it's hard to take serious. But yeah, he's dead serious. That
you guys just
like
both have such unusually unique last names. Like, why bother combining?
Just making a new outrageous last name. So on that note, hopefully that's not my new last name.
I think this is one where you got to put your foot down.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's not happening.
Watch, you get there and your marriage certificate has the combined last name on it. He's like, oops, I don't know what happened.
Oops, I have no clue how that one happened. Yeah, he would do that too. Mm-hmm. Anyways. Okay, let's get into it. Before we get going, be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Podcast by Proxy. Leave a review wherever you're listening. Spotify or Apple is the most helpful for those. You can leave a 5-star rating on Spotify or a 5-star rating and review on Apple. That's it, I think.
Yes.
You can send us a case suggestion on Gmail. I'm working on a case suggestion right now from the inbox. So we are working through them, but we can always use more because sometimes we just don't want to look for our own cases to cover. It's like so helpful
sometimes
when you guys send us case suggestions. It really keeps us going, so keep them coming.
Yeah.
Okay, so the defense team, Everton Bittersing's defense team, no shocker to anyone, essentially blames the entire thing on Elaine.
Shocker.
Yeah. So they really end up pitting one another like against each other. And the defense team argued that the experts had concluded Melanie had drowned, but that there was no evidence to show that Everton actually did it. They argued that Elaine drowned her because she hated her and believed she was possessed by the devil. As we've mentioned, Elaine is very religious. And this specifically was relied on heavily by the defense in an effort to show that Elaine was the main perpetrator in the abuse and death of Melanie. On cross-examination, wow, Everton's lawyer repeatedly suggested to Cleon that the punishments inflicted upon him and Melanie occurred when Elaine was upset or angry, and that whatever was happening to Melanie was like fundamentally driven by Elaine. And Cleon actually agreed that Elaine was a contributing factor to the abuse that they received. They kind of threw out this call Elaine the mastermind and Everton the fist. Like Elaine was like,
so he was the enforcer, but she made the directions.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong, I think it's easier for a step parent to like be jealous or angry or any number of emotions towards a stepchild. But like, God.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Elaine actually took the stand in Everton's trial and testified against him. She told the jury that in 2011, she had confessed to her pastor that the so-called, quote, suitcase girl abandoned in 1994 was her stepdaughter Melanie, claiming her long silence stemmed from her fear of her monster of a husband. So they kind of go really heavy into the domestic abuse side of it. It was actually Elaine's pastor that made the call to police in November of 2011. He was the one that phoned.
I was wondering if he did, the way you were saying that.
Yeah, he was the one that actually phoned and reported, which is how they eventually identified Melanie. We will go a little bit more into that because the pastor will actually testify in Elaine's trial.
Oh, okay.
Elaine testified that she found Melanie's dead body in a closet in the apartment and that she, Everton, and Cleon disposed of her body together. Elaine's pastor would end up testifying at her trial, like I mentioned, and we are going to go through that next.
Oh, okay.
Neither Cleon or Elaine ever testified to physically seeing Everton kill Melanie. However, the Crown maintained that Everton could be found guilty of first-degree murder because he either drowned her, helped drown her, deprived her of food and medical attention leading to her death, or caused her to become so weak that she could not get out of a situation where she would drown.
She also had multiple broken bones, potentially, and fractures of multiple different healing phases. Like,
yeah.
I don't care how much adrenaline you have, that is not something that you're necessarily going to be able to get up and move from.
Well, then they were essentially saying that, like, okay, even if he didn't physically drown her, because of the state she was in, she could have, like, fallen into a puddle on the balcony and drowned. Like, she was so weak and frail, and you did this to her, so you're still at fault.
Yeah.
Now, you may be wondering, why first-degree murder? Because you have to prove premeditation of the death. However,
I think you could have at any point changed the outcome, though.
Well, and remember that you can find somebody guilty of first-degree murder if there's aggravating circumstances. So if they were able to find that Melanie died while Elaine and Everton were forcibly confining her, this is automatic grounds for a first-degree murder conviction. So the aggravating factor here being that she was confined against her will allows them to find him guilty of first-degree murder.
Makes sense.
After Everton's trial ended, it took the jury of 7 women and 5 men only 4 hours of deliberation to find him guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to an automatic life sentence without parole for 25 years.
Good. How do you look at someone keeping a, like, young adult, essentially, confined, 50 pounds, and horribly beaten?
Yeah. Yeah, and, like, remember, she was a child. Like, this is a child abuse case.
Yep.
She was, what, 13 when she moved in with him? But either way, even at 17, like, she is technically still a child. And so, yeah, this is one of the worst child abuse cases, I think, in this country.
Yeah, I see what you mean now when I said, does it involve a child? And you were like, well, like, yes, it's someone's child, but she's of an age where she's,
I think a lot of the time when we think of child abuse, we think of, like, a child. Like, you know, a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, a 7-year-old, an 8-year-old. We don't always think of it being somebody who's, like, a teenager, but they are still a child at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that, like, 10 to 12, right before they get into those teen years, is where we kind of imagine it's no longer a child. Or someone's child.
Not the case.
Nope. And I remember how much I still needed my parents at 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. Like, I was calling my mom constantly, being like, what do I do?
25, 26.
Hell, I think you need your parents always, like, at every stage of life.
Yeah. So, Everton, he will not be eligible for parole until the year 2037.
Still too soon.
I actually saw some questions about this in our DMs recently, just about, like, the 25-year sentencing in Canada. And we have talked about it before, but just remember that just because somebody's eligible for parole after 25 years doesn't mean they'll get it. You still have to apply, you still have to meet certain criteria, and the parole board absolutely can and does reject people all the time who apply for parole at the 25-year mark. So don't think that it's just like 2037, he's out. There is a lot of stuff that goes into that. It's just everyone's right in Canada that if you have a life sentence, you're eligible to apply for parole after 25 years.
Yeah, it's still a whole interview process. You meet the parole board. They talk to other people throughout the prison systems. Like, it's not like, oh, okay, just punch out. You're good to go now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's often a misconception. So just wanted to...
Yeah, it's all we're saying is the 25 years makes parole eligibility. Mm-hmm. So you're eligible to apply for it. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to get it necessarily.
Don't get me wrong, Katie and I both often feel that there are people in the system that shouldn't even be eligible to apply for parole at 25 years because the family has to get involved. It's a whole re-victimization thing. They can reapply every, like, 4 years or something, which is just awful for
2 to 4, depending on what it's for, yeah.
The family and the people involved, victims, everything. So
I also think there's a lot of people that are on too long of sentences for the crimes they... Mm-hmm. committed, saying they won't get parole for X amount of years either, because I think we have a lot of people, like, who are, their race was a factor, mm-hmm. or they were wrongly accused. Like, I think there's the flip side to both, so
yeah,
yeah, it's just, it's a messed up situation.
Yeah. Now, even though there is an automatic sentence in this case, they do always still hold a sentencing hearing. This allows victims to read their victim impact statements and allows the court to formally sentence the person. So at the sentencing hearing, Superior Court Justice Al O'Mara, who presided over the trial, described Everton's actions against his daughter as monstrous and savage. When he asked if he had anything to say, Everton Bittersing responded, quote, "It won't do any good. It won't make any difference. No." So there's that.
Okay.
Yeah. Melanie's family, so her mother Opal Austin and her sister Raquel Ellis, actually came from Jamaica and sat through the trial. They returned to Jamaica on Christmas Day of that year in 2016. They stated, "We're glad, we're elated, he deserves it." And her mother Opal Austin, she was, of course, thrilled with the outcome, but she was just still so confused and could not understand, like, why anyone would do this to Melanie. She said she was, like, a quiet person. She never gave any problems. She loved drawing. She loved to read. She was just such a good kid. Her mother was just so, like, confused at still how this happened.
Well, the fact that, like, the dad really wanted all his kids here.
Yeah.
Like, he seemed like he really wanted to work on their relationships and, like, catch up with them and spend time with them before they were too grown up.
He duped them.
He did. He totally bamboozled them to come live here. And then, for whatever reason, possibly partially the stepmom, but that's not the reason. But maybe that created tension. But why was it, why was it taken out on her?
Yeah. I think I just said they returned on Christmas Day of 2016. I meant 2015 because this trial takes place at the end of 2015 and then the sentencing and trial wrapped up in February of 2016. And then Elaine's trial starts in April of the same year. So I just got that mixed up a little bit, but not a big deal. It's
a lot of dates close together, so that's fair.
So, yeah, the sentencing and trial for Everton wraps up in February of 2016. Next would be the trial for the first-degree murder against Elaine, which began in April of 2016. Elaine was also tried by a judge and a jury. Prior to her trial, she actually sought permission to have her case heard by a judge alone rather than a jury, and her defense essentially argues that her right to a fair trial would be compromised because of the media coverage of Everton's trial and the fact that she testified at it. This request was denied, and she was tried by a judge and a jury for the murder of Melanie.
Yeah, I don't know why she would have been granted a judge-only trial, unless also to keep some information quiet, but it's like, you did already testify. You put your information out there.
And I think that's why they asked for a judge alone trial, because they didn't think that they would be able to find an impartial jury just given the gravity of, like, the news coverage and everything. Yeah. But here's the thing. You can always find somebody who doesn't know.
Always.
Like, unless it's a celebrity or, like, the smallest town ever. Like, this is taking place, like, in Toronto. Like,
then you're not that important.
Right. You can pretty much, especially in a city like Toronto, always find somebody who wasn't paying attention to you.
It's like our biggest city. Yeah. You can find someone.
Yeah. I understand when it's, like, super, super, super small towns and it's this massively high-profile case. I understand sometimes in the case of celebrities. But in this case, like, not everybody is paying attention to you, girlfriend.
Without a doubt.
The court heard how Melanie's body went unidentified until 2011, when Elaine herself confessed to her pastor that Melanie had, quote, died like a dog after being confined and denied food and medication. She told the pastor that her husband killed his daughter, and this led the pastor to call police. Pastor Reverend Eduardo testified at Elaine's trial and stated Elaine's words to him were that Melanie was not fed, she was not given medical attention, she was not given anything. The court heard that the Bittersings had been members of Eduardo Cruz's congregation for about a year at that point. Did I miss his last name when I... Pastor Reverend Eduardo Cruz is his name.
Oh, okay. I just thought Eduardo was his last name.
No. Pastor Reverend Eduardo Cruz. I don't know how I missed that. oops. The court heard that the Bittersings had been members of Cruz's congregation for about a year at that point. The church had been helping them financially and emotionally as the family was very poor. One day, he says, Elaine lingered around the church until most other people had left and then asked to speak with Cruz alone about something very important, he recalled. He said, quote, she just told me they found the girl dead in the room. She didn't tell me, quote, I was upset or not upset. She did, however, tell him how Melanie's body ended up in the suitcase. He said that Elaine said, quote, I was watching a commercial on TV and I saw a commercial for luggage and I turned around and spoke to Everton and said, let's put her in the luggage. Yeah.
Okay.
Elaine then told Cruz that she, her husband, and a stepson, Cleon, drove to a rural area with the suitcase containing Melanie's body where the luggage was set on fire while she sat in the car. And of course, we know this is why Cleon was initially charged, because they keep saying that he was involved in the disposal of Melanie's body. After this conversation
if he's so abused too, he's gone along with so much that is not okay with him, because he also feels like he doesn't have another option. So I just think, like, give that guy a break.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like, imagine how scared you would be. Like, if I don't go along with this, this could be me.
Like, look what they're doing to her. I could just be next.
He's in survival mode.
Yeah.
So. So, yeah, she also basically says that, like, Melanie died like a dog, which I just can't get that, like, imagery out of my head. It's so awful to, like, have, like, she said that out loud.
You picture a dog left alone in a crate to die. It's terrible. Which is the same thing they did to her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so awful.
It is.
The fact that you could say that about a human being just, like, shows me that you were complicit in some regard. Like, you knew what was going on.
Yeah, no level of forgive me, Father, is going to take away what you've done.
Correct.
At this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, after this conversation, Pastor Cruz told Elaine that he was going to need to tell the police.
Yeah.
Cleon testified once again at Elaine's trial. He was considered a key witness for the prosecution in both the trial against Elaine and Everton. He was very brave. Yeah. At Elaine's trial, he outlined how Melanie was abused by Everton as punishment for failing to meet the demands of Elaine to care for her infant sister. So they really wanted her to be like the caretaker of the baby, Charmaine. She was forced to clean the apartment and care for the younger children until she was too weak to be of value. He also testified that Elaine considered Melanie dirty and devil-possessed, and as a result, like we mentioned before, forced her to shower on the balcony of the apartment. He also detailed all the same things that he detailed at Everton's trial related to the abuse. And he said Elaine would tell Melanie that she was evil and a curse to the family. And one time she even smashed a coffee cup on Melanie's head, which just kind of like negates the whole I had no idea what was going on.
When we can see that your hands played into part of what was going on.
Yeah.
This poor brother.
I know. Prosecutor Anna Tenhouse testified at Elaine's trial that she was an equal partner with Everton when it came to abusing Melanie, particularly when it came to depriving her of food. She quoted Cleon's testimony that described how Elaine was the mind and Everton was the fist. One of their children, O'Neill Bittersing, identified himself as the oldest son of Everton Elaine and was asked what his parents told him about Melanie, and his reply was, quote, they said she ran away or something like that.
Yeah, so how do you explain to your younger children that all of a sudden their sister's missing,
mm-hmm.
without having to be remorseful or sad? Yeah. They can be angry at her for running away now.
Yeah, well, and they told everyone she ran away, right? Oh, she was just so awful.
Even her mother. They were like, oh, she ran off
the States. She stole my clothes and jewelry and ran off to the States. Like, no, she didn't.
No. Why would she leave all her stuff behind and steal somebody else's? No.
Elaine's defense team, which was Alana Page and Jennifer Myers, suggested that Everton was to blame for Melanie's death and that Elaine was the victim of domestic violence. Alana Page stated that Elaine suffered abuse and isolation at the hands of Everton since she married him at the age of 18. They stated she had reported the abuse to authorities. However, records do not support this, and there's no mention of her reporting abuse of any of their children, including Melanie. So they're like, oh, okay. Yeah, she reported abuse against herself, but, like, not your children.
And again, this isn't like there's a bruise that Melanie's hiding or that behind closed doors he's speaking to her in such a way that's horrendous. Like, she's in a closet in a barrel. Like,
and I think that there's a world in which both things could exist. Like, yes, it's very possible that this was a really unhealthy relationship and that she was the victim of domestic violence at times, but also was complicit in the behavior that was going on to the children, specifically Melanie. Like, I don't think it's a black and white situation where they can't coexist, but to say that you had no idea what was going on and that you, like, couldn't, like, the things that happened to Melanie and, like, Cleon and Dwayne were just so outrageous that I don't think that that's a very viable defense.
No, and we know that they lived in very close quarters. There's not a lot of space to hide or keep things quiet. And I don't necessarily disagree that she wasn't abused, but in no capacity like these children are.
Again, in this trial, they basically just pin everything on Everton. It's the he did it game. The defense suggests that Melanie died when her father held her head down the toilet as punishment, causing her to drown. We know that her cause of death is unclear. There are a lot of different ways that she could have died, but the expert evidence had indicated that she inhaled water of some sort shortly before her death. Elaine's lawyers did not call any of their own evidence, and Elaine did not testify in this trial in her own defense. But they essentially argued that Elaine was unaware that Melanie's life was at risk. Which, again, I just call bullshit on. And I think a lot of other people do, too.
Yeah, that's not... No.
Jennifer Myers told the jury in her closing address that the responsibility for Melanie's death rests solely with Everton. She said Elaine would seclude herself in the bedroom reading the Bible and watching religious TV shows.
So in, like, the one bedroom where this closet was that Melanie was kept in?
They literally just said that she locked herself in the bedroom and watched religious TV shows and read the Bible and had no idea what was going on.
This just leads to another series of, okay, then was she kept in a closet that was in, like, the general area of the house, which you then would have also seen and known?
It's all just, who did you think was going to believe that?
You're not helping your case here, lady.
Myers also told the jury the Crown could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Elaine knew Melanie's life was in danger or played any role in her death, and again stated that Elaine didn't know the extent of Melanie's condition. I just don't know that that was the defense that was going to get you out of this.
I don't know if that would have been the one I went with.
I don't think so. Crown prosecutors, of course, argued that Elaine had failed in her duties as a parent, noting that she believed Melanie was possessed by the devil and treated her much differently than her own children. They argued that she played an active and substantial role in Melanie's death, and given her condition, it would have been impossible for Elaine not to know the abuse was occurring. Cleon's testimony was a huge part of the prosecution's case to outline the treatment of Melanie at the hands of both Elaine and Everton. In June of 2016, Elaine Bittersing was found guilty of second-degree murder by the jury. As the verdict was read, Elaine shook her head and picked up the Bible that she had brought into court with her and just started reading it.
Just like she did locked in that bedroom.
Justice McDonald stated that while their reasons for hating Melanie may have differed, quote, Everton and Elaine's antipathies came together in a combination that led directly to the shocking mistreatment of Melanie, end quote. Melanie came to Canada with hopes and dreams. The persons entrusted with her care crushed those hopes and dreams with a cruel, callous, relentless, and ultimately lethal course of physical, psychological, and emotional abuse. What happened to Melanie is inexplicably sad.
It is. There's no reason that this should have happened.
Correct. After Elaine was found guilty of second-degree murder, a sentencing hearing was held and scheduled and held in September of 2016. So for second-degree murder, it's a little bit different. The minimum sentence in Canada is life with no possibility of parole for 10 years up to a maximum of 25 years. So the minimum time that you would serve before being eligible for parole is 10 years, and then they can kind of sentence you anywhere between 10 and 25. I think we often see second-degree murder fall somewhere between, like, 12 and 16, I would say, yeah, as, like, an average.
I think that's fair.
Elaine's defense attorney, Alana Page, argued that Elaine should receive the briefest parole ineligibility period available, citing that she was the victim of domestic violence herself and that she was not an equal partner to Everton in the abuse. Her defense also argued that Elaine should receive some credit for cooperating with the investigation by speaking with police and testifying at Everton's trial. And I'm like, eh.
No, you don't get good behavior now because after the fact you helped.
Like 20 years later, because your pastor ratted on you. Like, yes, yeah, like, I understand. You felt
guilty enough.
She went to the pastor, but I almost feel like her testifying in his trial and things like that was an effort to, like, get the blame all put on him and to save herself. Yeah. I don't think it was it for anything to do with Melanie and, like, caring about her.
And her and the dad, like, the husband, are still together, aren't they, at this time? Like, they haven't split up over that 20 years, have they? So, correct. Like, she's not doing it, like, vindictively.
They were still together.
It's just that her conscience is eating at her, so she finally tells someone, and it... Mm-hmm. Unfortunately brings it all to the surface for their part.
Yeah, that's just kind of how I feel, but
I agree.
So she throws a little bit of a fit in the sentencing hearing. First of all, in the sentencing hearing, she brings her Bible again and she placed it open and, like, upturned on the table in front of her. As the judge reads her sentence, he states that she is sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole for 16 years. And Elaine then screams at the judge, saying, quote, "I didn't murder anybody. I'm not guilty of anything." She then continued yelling, calling Crown prosecutors Anna Tenhouse and Mary Humphrey bitches and witches, and then accuses four jury members who were sitting in the courtroom of corruption. She screamed at the judge, quote, "You instructed them to find me guilty, Jesus."
Jesus.
And then basically the judge warned her that he would not tolerate another outburst from her and would throw her directly in jail.
And, like, tell me you're guilty without telling me you're guilty.
Yeah, she has, like, a full fit meltdown in the middle of the courtroom.
Yeah, no.
With her Bible. Not buying it. No. Cleon stated in his victim impact statement at Elaine's trial that he, like I said, he did not pass his surname to his four children because of the grief it holds from the actions of both his father and stepmother. Not shockingly, both Elaine and Everton appeal their sentences, their guilty verdicts. Elaine appealed her guilty verdict and argued that the judge who oversaw her trial was wrong to dismiss her application for a judge-alone trial and that he set the test to grant a judge-alone trial so high that it was impossible to meet. The trial judge found that the evidence she filed did not support the suggestion that 12 impartial jurors could not be found. The judge also had ruled that the risk of jurors coming across potentially prejudicial information after being selected could be mitigated through the usual means, such as instructions to not look up anything having to do with the case. So, like, normal court proceeding rules.
Yeah. And if for any reason it escalates, they get segregated. Like, there's still procedures in place to make sure that juries are impartial.
Yeah. You're not the only one whose case has been on the news.
No.
The Court of Appeal for Ontario found in January of 2022 that the trial judge, quote, "properly considered the evidence and the general protections in place to ensure fair jury trials and reached a decision that was free from error." The appeal panel noted the judge considered the circumstances of the case as well as the general safeguards regarding juries. For example, the panel wrote, the judge pointed out that the survey showed 46% of respondents had not heard or seen anything in the media regarding Melanie's death, and 74% had not heard anything about Bittersing herself. Elaine also appealed on the grounds that the judge erred in admitting some statements she made to police and in his instructions to the jury, but those arguments were also rejected by the court. So essentially, they said, no, ma'am, you may not
appeal.
No
way, Jose. Yeah.
So her guilty verdict and sentence were upheld by the appeal court. Everton also appealed his guilty verdict, arguing that the judge who presided over his trial erred in allowing jurors to consider a suggestion that he starved his daughter to death. All his grounds...
She was 50 pounds. How could you not see that that could be the case?
Yeah, he relied... Well, he's weighing really heavily into, like, basically saying that you relied on saying that she drowned. I don't know. His appeal doesn't make a lot of sense. All his grounds for appeal related to evidence regarding what caused Melanie's death. So in a unanimous ruling released in April of 2020, the Court of Appeal for Ontario dismissed Everton's appeal, saying the judge was not mistaken in leaving that option with the jury. Why okay. would they not suggest that you starved her to death?
Yeah, I don't... That is confusing. But yeah, you starved her. That is a factor.
Yeah, it's just like, why would they not give that option when she was, like you said, 50 pounds?
I don't know.
The judge said, quote, in this case, there was both lay and medical evidence which could have supported an inference that Melanie's death was caused by her either extreme state of starvation, whether following a near drowning event or independent of any drowning. The three-judge panel also rejected Everton's suggestion that the judge erred in allowing one of the experts who examined Melanie's body to provide an alternate cause of death should jurors disregard his evidence on her probable drowning. So it basically all related to her cause of death.
Yeah. Which I think was explained very well in the trial.
Mm-hmm.
And the reasoning behind made great sense.
Yep. Melanie's case was investigator Steve Ryan's last homicide investigation while working the cold case unit in 2012. He said that her case was essentially so awful that, like, he couldn't do it anymore. He said the gruesome details of the murder of Melanie, followed by the long prosecution of her killers, took a personal toll. He couldn't stomach seeing another case like this one, like another child treated this way, betrayed, hurt, exploited by her own family. So he gave it up after this. He credited many other agencies for the arrests of both Everton and Elaine, the Jamaican authorities, Niagara Regional Police, the RCMP, York Regional Police, the Coroner's Office, and the Center for Forensic Sciences. After the trials of Everton and Elaine, Councillor Michael Thompson got City Council to approve an effort to basically establish a registry that would require all immigrant children to report their stages of settlement, such as their school enrollment.
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad idea.
Yeah. And that's it.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Super sad.
There's like no words for this one.
I know.
I just don't know how someone can sit and just watch someone suffer.
Yeah.
Especially somebody that you're supposed to care about, like a child.
Not even just suffer, but like she had, what, 21 broken bones. She would have had a hard time breathing.
Well, they said she was in agony.
Like, I can't at all times. Imagine how you could possibly treat someone like that and watch them die. And do nothing.
I know. It takes a rare breed of person, I think, to be able to just ignore anything.
It's
like
wild.
That. It's so messed up.
Yeah. And, like, her poor mother, who just wanted her to have a better life, like, she was just trying to help her and... Yeah.
And the fact that her mom's, like, she wasn't even, like, a difficult kid.
Nope.
It's not like there was a reason why someone could have, like, snapped at her or been angry. Like, she just was such a good kid.
Mm-hmm. I know. This case was awful, but when I was first reading about it, I was like, I feel like this needs to be told.
It does. Like, you're right. I need
to tell it, even though it's the worst.
Yeah. Those are the ones that are important to tell, though, to make sure these things stop happening.
Yeah. But that's it. That is the case of Melanie Bittersingh. I'm really hoping that Elaine and Everton both don't continue to appeal their convictions. Lord knows they probably will, but... You know,
yeah.
One can dream.
Dare to dream, people.
And yeah, my next case, I'm going to cover a case suggestion. Excited for that. We love a good case suggestion. Trying to think if there's anything else like true crimey related that I can share.
I don't think we've had a ton of updates because, again, we've recorded so recently together that we haven't even had a full week of news to come out. Like,
yeah, totally.
You're I just don't think there's much that we could go over in terms of.
I did see there was the Amber Alert recently in BC for the 3-month-old, and I believe that they were found.
Yeah, the mother went into a local hospital with the child and I believe handed him back over with no issues, but
okay.
It's still got to be such a traumatic experience for that family.
Yeah.
And let's just hope that none of this has any consequences on the child long term. I know they're very young, but we don't know what that kind of stuff happens.
Yeah.
And what it does.
There was... a missing persons case recently that I had posted about, and maybe I can go over that briefly before we wrap up. It was actually one of our listeners that messaged us on Instagram asking if we could post about it. And so if you are on Vancouver Island like we are, in the Saanich area, a 23-year-old male, Keelan Hall, is still considered missing. He was last seen on March 14th leaving a residence near Cooper and Admiral's Road on foot at 6 a.m. They do have a photo of him taken at like 10 p.m. the night before that they've released. So it's been a few weeks now since he was last seen. He was on foot wearing a black zip-up Nike jacket, dark-colored long pants, black and white Air Jordan shoes, and a dark-colored Atlanta Braves hat. Hall is described as 6 feet tall and about 180 pounds with blue-gray eyes and short brown hair. He has several tattoos, including a black widow spider with a web behind his left ear, a melting smiley face on the inside of his right forearm, a devil tattoo on his chest, and a newly tattooed dollar sign on his left thumb. So if you do see any sightings of him or you know what might have happened to Keelan, you can call Saanich Police at 250-475-4321 or you can email majorcrime@saanichpolice.ca. You can also report anonymously to Crime Stoppers. And it looks like there is actually a Facebook group now if you want to get more information on his disappearance. It's called Finding Keelan Hall. That's K-I-E-L-A-N Hall. The Facebook group has quite a few members, actually. I think it's like, 2,500 members as of right now. There's posts like up to an hour ago. So there's like a missing persons poster and things like that in there. But if you do know at all what might have happened to Keelan, you are encouraged to call the police. That's a local missing person.
That's so sad, though.
That I figured I would do a shout out for. Yeah, it is very sad.
Yeah, no, that's really important. I'm glad that you brought it up because I didn't know about that, to be honest.
Yeah, I've been listening. I think I mentioned this on last week, 2 days ago's episode.
About way back when.
Disappeared podcast that I've been listening to.
Yeah.
And missing persons is just such a, how does somebody just vanish? It's just wild. Weirdly traumatic. To me. It is. It's.
Yeah, those people that just disappear without a trace. Like Michael Dennehy.
Mm-hmm.
That case, like he's just gone.
Yeah.
It, like, fascinates me in the most morbid way because I don't understand how someone can just disappear without a trace.
Well, like, Emma Filipov, that one out of Victoria as well, where it's like she's on all these surveillance cameras, police talk to her, and then she's just gone.
Gone. Yeah, it's... she's, like, seen all over the place almost for a bit. And then just poof.
Yeah, it's just, it blows my mind. Anyways, I figured I would give that case a little shout out. Shout out. Is that the right word?
Shout out.
A little bit of time. Just to get some more attention out about that, because that was only a couple of weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago now, that he went missing. So they're very much still looking for Keelan Hall. And that's it. That's all.
That is shocking and sad, your case. And also very sad that Keelan's still missing.
It's all sad. And
again, very strange that someone can just, like, up and disappear. It's such a weird concept.
Listen, we don't discuss a lot of happy stuff around here, unfortunately.
No, we do that before we hit record.
Yeah, we do.
We do. We gotta... Just so people don't think this is all we talk about.
Yeah, it's not the only thing we talk about. We do talk about happy stuff sometimes, too. Anyway.
Yeah. But...
thank you for joining us for the case of Melanie Bittersing, part 1 and 2, and we will be back next week.
Next week. Bye.
Bye. I'll call you soon.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
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 How do I stop this shit?
I'll stop it.
Okay.